Where else can you go to not only find the information on how to train your dog, but the best deals on training equipment as well? Standing Stone Supply has everything you need to create that next versatile champion, from DT system electronics down to even emergency med kits to take with you on your hunting trips. If you need some help with your training program, then their step-by-step online course might be a great fit for you, making it a convenient one-stop shop for the knowledge as well as the gear to take your training to the next level. Hit up standingstonesupply.com and promo code GDIY will save you 10%. Being an upland hunter in the South nowadays unfortunately means a lot of travel to try and find birds for my dogs. This means it's even more important that my map scouting is reliable to justify the effort. This is where Onyx comes in. I can honestly say that Onyx directly impacts the level of success I find on my trips. Whether it's the private versus public land boundaries, the expanding number of unique layers and features by state, or the 3D mapping capabilities, my initial step in planning my hunting trip starts with Onyx. To know where you're going, you have to first know where you stand. Check out Onyx Hunt Maps and use code GDIY20 at checkout to save 20%.
So we all want to train a dog. It should work like that. You should maybe move from point A to point B, stop there, blah, blah, blah. It's a method. Everything should happen like that. And that's what we train for. So I know exactly what my outrun, we call it the way the dog goes around the sheep. I know what I want. So I train for that. But then if you just train that, you're making a problem for yourself. Because that's in a very controlled circumstances. You have to learn to put variation in there.
One thing we all love to do with our dogs is hit the road and go on new adventures. In order for that to happen, we have to be able to safely and efficiently travel with our dogs. Dakota 283 is dedicated to building unparalleled pet protection and tailgate lifestyle products for you and your best friends. Their one-piece roto-molded kennels have many options, such as the Hero Series for military-grade crates, T1 low-profile kennels that will fit truck beds with tonneau covers, and their most popular G3 Series that's available in any size you'll need. Dakota not only offers many different sizes and styles of kennels, they also offer products and accessories to help with food and water transport, truck bed storage, and even grooming stations. Have a new puppy and only want to buy one kennel instead of buying multiple ones as they grow? Look at the Forever Kennel Insert Divider that gives you the ability to buy a kennel now and adjust the size and side as needed. No matter what you need to get you on your next adventure with your dog, Dakota has it for you. Check them out now at dakota283.com. Your new 283 lifestyle is just one click and free shipping away. We get asked all the time what the most important thing to consider is when training and living with a hunting dog, and they're often surprised when they hear us answer with proper nutrition. It's pretty obvious when you think about it, though. It doesn't matter how well the dog is trained if it doesn't have the right fuel. The saying garbage in, garbage out rings true in dog nutrition. Eukanuba's premium performance lineup goes beyond just protein and fat, with a number of different formulas designed to fuel your dog's specific activity level while supporting their recovery and optimizing their nutrient delivery. The proof is in the pudding, or lack thereof, when you make the switch to Eukanuba. You'll see immediate results in your dog's energy level and drive. They have a formula for every type of dog, from your hardest working dog in the field to your laziest retired dog on the couch. Head on over to EukanubaSportingDog.com to find the right formula for your hunting partner. Make the switch today and let Eukanuba fuel your dog so you can focus on what you and your dog actually love to do, work.
All right, everybody. We are joined with Fonzie Bassone this week. Fonzie, thanks for making time to come on and talk to us about a world that we're not really familiar with in the gun dog world, and that's the fascinating world of sheep dogs.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nick.
Absolutely. So, you know, I guarantee you have listeners right now that are wondering what the heck sheepdogs have to do with gun dogs, right? And so, really, the whole point of this episode that by the end of it, I want to get to is how it translates and what we do with working with our dogs and the cooperation and teamwork that it takes and the obedience level to work with dogs at such a great distance that you do. But I think, you know, let's obviously backtrack and introduce you and kind of explain exactly what you do and your experience.
Okay, Nick, I think the one thing I want to say about, you know, you say maybe what do sheepdogs have to do with hunting dogs, and just to get us going, sheepdogs are really hunting dogs because they hunt the sheep. And over the years, their instinct just been changed with breeding, so they hunt in a specific way. But the way the dog goes around the sheep and work the sheep and do all different kinds of them, it's a prey drive, really. So, you know, there's more similarities, I think, than most people would really think about.
So do they really derive from hunting? Like, what did they, like you said it was prey drive, but did they have a different type of prey before people really directed that in the direction of sheep?
Yeah, I'm sure they did, because even if you look like the African wild dogs and you go and see how they hunt, you'll see some of those dogs will, for instance, when they come around, they'll push from behind, and some dogs will actually go around and flank around their prey. So I'm 100% sure that there's an old instinct there. And the ultimate thing for most dogs is to get it, to really sort of, you know, take it down sometimes, even if you let them. So we teach them and we try to breed them so they don't do that. But there's definitely a hunting instinct in these dogs. And I think from many, many years ago, when I started out the sheepdogs, I read a lot of old magazines and stuff about the UK. And a lot of those old-timers, you know, they'll work the dogs in the day shepherding, and at night they'll go and poach game and all kinds of stuff using the same dog to hunt.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't know that. But, I mean, it does make sense, like you said. I mean, either way, you're kind of – I don't know if manipulating is the right word, but I guess that's really what it is you're taking the dog's drive and just directing it and manipulating it towards the job and task that you want the dog to do. So it makes sense that they would also be able to use it in a hunting manner outside of herding sheep. It's kind of the same drive that pushes both of them.
Absolutely. It's definitely the same.
So, you know, again, let's go ahead and introduce you, and then I really want to break down the sheepdog world because I'm not very familiar with it. I know most of my listeners aren't going to be as well. So let's go ahead and introduce you. You know, where do you come from, and how did you end up working primarily with sheepdogs?
Okay, I'm going to try and make it not too long, Nick. Well, I grew up in South Africa, and I grew up in a sort of a big town, you know, not as well, a lot of people for the city, but it's a fairly big town. But my passion is always like wildlife and to be outdoors, and seldom got the chance. I played a lot of sports. But then when I was 16, I think I was driving my mother nuts, to be honest, because I just wanted to go somewhere. And she found me a job, a weekend holiday job, basically, on a sheep farm from a friend of him. And it was about 3,000 merino ewes, and I can't remember exactly, it's about 10,000 acres. And I remember the very first day, I was only 16 years old, never been on a sheep farm before. The very first day, the guy, I don't think he knew what to do with me, the husband, because it was like, what do I do with this kid that knows nothing? But I like dogs. I always had dogs at home. And he had a little dog called Yappy, and it was a Kelpie Border Collie cross. And I was just fascinated. This thing could run around the sheep, could stop the sheep, and could come back when you call. And I thought it was broken. My very first day, I met this dog. And the second thing I encountered was sheep shearing. And it's interesting because those two things stuck with me for the last, I'm going to be 50 in 3 days. So for the last couple of decades, it really stuck with me, and I excelled a little bit in sheepdogs, and I did them shearing, but I finally become a fairly good shearer too. So, you know, that sort of trickled my career as a sheep farmer, and I decided I'm going to do that after my compulsory military training, which we all had to do. I went to an agricultural school, which is famous for sheep and goats, and very specific into the wool business, and I found a job in that area after I finished up, and you know, started farming for somebody. What we call ranching, mostly we call farming. And you know, it wasn't long before I got the first dog. Somebody said, "Well, you should get a sheepdog to help you," and know nothing about that, but I knew dogs. You know, I could get on with dogs. So I found a nice little dog, and somehow we managed to get around. I don't know how it worked, because I had absolutely nobody telling me what to do. I remember one day we were gathering. I had a couple of colored people working for me, and we were gathering up some sheep, just walking. And this pup was just walking with me, and the next moment he just took off and ran around in a big arc, cast out around the sheep. And I was like, man, that's pretty cool, you know. And sort of, he trained me. It's probably more than I trained him. His name was Billy. That was my first dog.
Wow.
So he became, he became a really good all around type of dog. I did anything with that dog, and he was a bad dog, you know. He went to do all the sport things, and he went everywhere. He stayed always with me. So it was a good start to me. I had a pretty good start on the type of dog I think I had, and sort of set my course for me a little bit to what I could expect from dogs.
So you literally landed with these dogs from a need of really a tool with your career and on the farmstead, and just needing to have help with these dogs. And like you said, you know, it's very similar to when most people say they get their first gun dogs, that, you know, the dog teaches them more so than they teach the dog. And so you pretty much just jumped in with both feet because you needed help on your farm.
Yeah, basically that's how it worked. You know, we found farm big areas, like the guy I was working for. We're about 50,000 hectares, which is about 120,000 acres, and it's very extended areas. So we ran about 10,000 ewes, so we had a lot of ground to cover. Different farms, different towns. So a dog just, let's put it this way: a good dog make your day real short. A bad dog make your day real long. So. Fortunately, sometimes I make more work than they help you, but I was fortunate, you know. I had a pretty good one to start. And I never even knew there was sheepdog competitions in our country. I remember as a kid, me and my dad will watch, it was called One Man and His Dog, the BBC in England showed that, and I was like 10 years old, and we watched that, and, you know, I thought about years later, I even thought about that. But when I was working with dog, I didn't even know about sheepdog competitions until one day somebody mentioned to me that this guy lived in a town called Grafenet, which is far away from us. And I thought, okay, that's cool. In the meantime, I got married. So my wife is super keen to dog too. So, you know, we went and I went to go and visit this old guy. He was one of the founder members of the Sheepdog Society, and I think it was founded in 1961. And he was old then. He passed away since, but he was a pretty old guy then. And he showed me, he worked his dog, but his dog was also old. Mm-hmm. So he lived in a small holding, and he put the sheep through the gates and showed me. And then he said, well, I want to see your dog work. You know, and I took my dog out and worked my dog a little bit. And he looked at me and he said, well, you better get to a sheepdog trial pretty quick. So, you know, and then I found out where they were holding them. And so that's how I got sort of, I'm a little bit of a freak for competition. I like to compete, you know, so that sort of suited me well. It's like, let's see how good this dog can be. And that's how we slowly started into the competition. So.
Gotcha. So you just kind of landed in the world of competition. It sounds like it just fit for you and made a lot of sense. So I want you, let's break down what a sheepdog actually does, because I have a feeling that, like, most people listening to this, like, maybe they're only familiar with sheepdogs here in America as far as, like, if they watched the movie Babe growing up, right? Describe the work that the dog does, you know, just take us through a typical sheepdog run as it is on the farm, and then let's kind of compare that to how it is in a competition and trial.
Okay, so let's see. So where I lived when I was married, I lived on a property was like 12,000 acres on a mountain. And we only ran 2,000 sheep in that property, but we had a lot of predators. So we counted all the sheep every week. So you basically walk on foot to gather there, because you can't really get on a horse, motorbike, or it was really a little bit of a rough terrain. So, you know, a dog will do easily 15 to 20 miles on a day like that, because you send him out around the sheep, left or right, you decide, and he can go out. Most dogs, you can send them out, they can hear you at about 1,000 yards if your wind's blowing pretty good and it's, you know, everything is good, they'll hear you that. And we seldom send them that far, but I would say 500, 600, 700 yards is an average cast out. You might pick up a few stragglers, pick the sheep up. You might redirect him to get another group. So all this time you're working in a certain direction of this whole flock. You might have to turn him back at some point to send him back there. And then once you got the flock all bunched up, you might take him to a work area. Or what I did is I just count him right there. So you'll funnel the sheep. The sheep will go between me and the dog, and I'll count them. You know, count 500-600 sheep in one go. The dog better listen, because I always thought that's one thing with my dogs, which make them good, is because I had to count a lot of sheep. And so that will be sort of a gathering day. And then there's times when we're shearing or when you're lambing. So lambing time, you know, you might use the dog actually to catch a sheep. If the sheep's lambing and the lamb gets stuck and it can't get out, you'll put the dog down, shed the sheep off. Shedding off means you cut it off, take it separate, and then you catch it. The dog literally had to catch it. Pull the lamb out, and then the dog might hold you with the lamb a little bit before you let it go. So that will be lambing. Shearing is always the hardest time for dogs, because all the sheep had to be moved long distances into the shearing set. Those are the days I have to wake my dog up seldom, but I had to wake him up. But shearing time, I normally have to wake him up because they work so hard in that time. You know, sheep come in, they go out, and it's long distances. So those are just practical things. And you know, I seldom used one dog. I must probably use two or three dogs at the same time.
And so touch on that real quick, because, you know, picture a big group of sheep. You know, you're directing two to three dogs, like you just said, at these distances. You said normally 500 to 700 yards, but it can go up to 1,000 yards. You know, what's that like? To you're counting sheep, or, you know, getting them ready to go shear, but you're also directing traffic with three different dogs.
So, I mean, I didn't do this in the beginning, right? I learned how to do this. Well, and this is where the trialing part, competition part, is good for me, because I was like, I wanted to base a part in competition, which we call brace or doubles, and I wanted to do that. But basically, you'll put, what I did is I put all my dogs in the same stop command and same walk-up command, and then, but they'll all be in different left and right commands, and all be in different left and right whistles. So I had five different set of whistles. And the idea is that if you have a big flock and you have to push it somewhere, if you say go left, you don't want everybody to go left, because who's going to flank to the right then?
Right.
So it makes it so much easier if you can control, you know, multiple dogs at one time. Some dogs get a little greedy, you know, they try to work too much, they compete a lot when they work, but you normally work that out of it before lunchtime because they get a little tired.
So I got to ask, you know, you just said that you have different commands, your stop, walk up, left and right. I think there was a fifth one. Did I miss one?
Well, basically, it's basic commands will be, okay, the dog has to stop.
Mm-hmm.
He has to get up when you ask him. And get up means walk straight in. Then you have a left and a right. But it's a lot more complicated than that, because you might have a big left or a little left or a slicey left or an open left. When it gets to finer detail,
gotcha.
The left and right, and then we'll put a turn back on the dog, which means go back, turn him around, and then left and right again. And then most dogs will, you know, will say, come in here if we want to shed. We'll teach him. So there's quite a bunch of commands to put on them.
So you have all these commands. You said that the trick is being able to give the commands to one dog at a time so that you're not turning or sending all three dogs in the same direction. How do you differentiate, and how do the dogs know? Is there just, do you do it by name or a certain whistle and then give a command? You know, how do you differentiate to who you're directing traffic? Because this is a lot of similarities in gun dogs when you have multiple dogs in the field and you got this one honoring while that one's supposed to go get a retrieve. Yeah. You know, is there, just walk us through how you do your command structure to where the dogs know who you're speaking to at that level of a distance.
Okay, Nick, so what I'll do is the dog, I always prefer them to be on different left and right. So let's say traditional will say come by for left and away for right. So I'll put one on come by and away, and then I'll say keep off, go ahead, that's left and right, or behind and get over, another command. So I'm going to I teach the dog individual first, right? So we must understand the basics of what we do before I try to work them together.
Mm-hmm.
But they say, I got an older dog, it's fairly well trained, and I got a dog that's upcoming, and I think, okay, he's getting to a point now I start to trust him to working with other dogs. I lay him down at my feet, and if I can't keep him there, I'll have a rope on him. But no, for most of the time, I can keep him there. And I take the older dog, and while this young dog's laying down at my feet, I work the older dog a little bit. And after 5 minutes or maybe 2 minutes, I'll stop the older dog and I'll put the young dog around and lay the older dog down. So, but the young dog learns that it's not every time he's time to work, because that's the thing. These dogs are so incredibly keen to work, they can't help themselves. So mm-hmm. all shepherds used to say, you train a dog to work and then you train him not to work. Now that's the situation. We almost train him not to work. Then once it gets comfortable to work when another dog lies down, I start to work them simultaneously, and in the beginning I use their names a lot. So let's say I have a dog called Sam and Jack. You know, I'll run Sam, get up, I'll say, Sam, get up. And if Jack gets up, I get after him, lighting him. So the names are important in the beginning. Later on, it's not important. But in the beginning, for young dogs, it's important. So, and then it's just a question of, you have to be really consistent. You know, if I make a mistake, you can't let it go. You have to stop everything, start over. So let's say I got him working, and I'm just practicing now, and I say, Sam, come by, and Jack, take off in a way flank or whatever. I need to stop everything and start over, because I can't let him get away with it now. So it's very, very disciplined in the beginning to get them. They must be disciplined, but you must also be disciplined. But why I was fascinated by it, because it's exactly some of the things I try to teach doing. So when we, for instance, teach a technique or a method, we look at the technique and method, and they call it the inner focus. And then when we look at what we're trying to achieve, let's say you're trying to hunt a bird, or in my case, I'm trying to put the sheep in a certain spot, it's sort of an outside focus. The majority of people just want to do the second one. You know, they just want to get out there and do the job, but they don't look at the technique, because it's only by developing a real good technique and method that you can get a high skill level. And it is pretty fascinating how many relations I can pull between what we were talking about and the way I teach us.
Yeah. I mean, there's similarities in everything. I mean, you know, everything starts with the foundation. And what we like to say a lot in the gun dog world is, it starts in the short grass before you go to the long grass. And so, just like you said, talking about getting the dogs used to not working and working with other dogs, you have all these commands that you have to teach prior to going out there. And so one that stands out very clearly between your world and our world is, you called it stop, we call it whoa. Just being able to get the dog to stop when it needs to stop. And, you know, again, very similar when we're out in the field with the upland and bird dogs, you know, you have a lot of dogs that are 400 or 500 yards out. And, you know, usually when you're out there hunting wild birds, you're not commanding the dog to whoa usually. Some people do, but, you know, that's not the goal, but sometimes you need to do it. These dogs are trained to do it at a distance. Walk us through how you go about doing it on the sheepdogs, because again, I'm sure there's a lot of overlap and a lot of similarities. You know, take us through step one to when you can trust your dog at 1,000 yards.
Okay. So this is going to be maybe a little different from what you guys do.
Okay.
So when a young dog starts to work, well, I always believe you can't make them work. So you have to let them work in the beginning. You can't force them. They must want to do it. So there's a phase, I call it the stimulation phase, and it's normally a brief period of time where I sort of give them the sheep quite a bit. So I start in a small area, and they can almost do what they want to, but I don't let them bite the sheep, because most youngsters will come in and they'll bite the sheep. And then when I know this dog's really keen, the first thing I do is definitely not put the lie down. And the first thing I do is I get him off the sheep. So I go through the sheep and I put corrections on him, pushing him off the sheep until he stay off. And he can only come back in when I'm backing up. This is all real at hand stuff now. It happens. It happens real close. So once I get him to go off the sheep, you know, I already changed the dog's mind a little bit, because now he's thinking about the sheep and me. He's not just thinking about the sheep. So now it starts to become easy to put the stop on. We always put this neutral position. That means the sheep's not going anywhere when I try to stop them. But if they're too keen, if they come forward too much on the sheep, and you think, my goodness, they're coming, they're going to eat, you better get them off the sheep first before you can try and stop him. And this principle is one of the things I teach from beginners to open level. Open level dogs have the same problem. You send them out 600 yards, the wind's blowing wrong, they can't hear you. They've never learned to respect the sheep enough. So now they're winding up, they're getting behind them, they come faster and faster because it becomes a chase and they can't stop. Where if they were backed up the sheep a little bit more and had more feeling and control in the sheep, they would have stopped better. So the first thing that I do is I want that in the dog's mind. And I want the dog to understand, okay, you work the sheep, but it's my sheep. You can't come in and bust him up. Before I do the lie down, because the lie down can be quickly becomes a very negative connotation for a young dog, because he wants to go forward and you keep stopping him, mm-hmm. and he doesn't understand why. So before you know it, I always tell people, you're going to run out of your lie downs if you keep doing that. And the dog's 3 years old and you have no stop on him, because there are some of them. So if you stop him right, they're very easy to stop in a certain way. But first of all, they must learn not to chase it. The secrets in what I do, and I tell people that, but it is a little bit of a secret if you understand it right, because then your problems go away, because suddenly the emphasis is not really in stopping the dog anymore, because he's controlling the sheep correctly. So that's a little different, you know. It's with us, most people will lie the dog down on the belly, and some people allow him to stand. With mine, I choose to make him lie down at the beginning. As they grow up and get older, they can stand, and the reason why is just, it makes it easier when they lie down. I'm sure they does. I can see it, and they can learn to wait a little bit for me. But I do not try and stop dogs. That's crazy on the sheep, if you understand what I mean. They have to get off the sheep a little bit first, though.
Gotcha. So it's kind of like you don't want them to learn that if they're on the sheep to stop. It's kind of learning by association. If they learn that if I'm on the sheep and I stop, that's what you want, then you're just going to have a dog that's stopping all the time every time they get on a sheep.
Yeah, unfortunately. And what happens, you know, it's a bit of a, if let's say your dog come in, like I say, they are hunting the sheep and he comes in behind at a far distance and the sheep really take off and you lay that dog down, then they get desperate because now the sheep escapes.
Yeah.
So the next stop's going to be harder, and the third one, you can't stop him anymore because he's not been trained properly. So that's why we call it the pace. The pace behind the sheep are extremely important. You know, the dog should, you should not harass the sheep. My rule number one in clinics is the sheep are the most important thing in what we do. So no dog will harass the sheep. And I let my dogs every now and then, you know, they can defend themselves, and it's not that we never bite the sheep, but that's all well controlled. And I'll tell you a real quick story.
Yeah.
We moved on eventually from where I left, stayed in the Karoo area, and we moved to the Southern Cape area about 10 years ago and started farming there. And it's very different, it's very intensive farming, rolling hills and alfalfa and wheat and small grains. So we ran a very intensive sheep setup there. Anyway, so I sent a dog over this hill one day, and I knew it was about 300 ewes, and I wanted to feed them, and I was working on my, I bolted a little feed car behind my pickup. So the dog went around, some of the sheep came over, and the dog didn't come back. And, you know, after a while, keep whistling, run, come on, come on, come on. Eventually, he came over, bring the sheep through the gate, and I'm laying down at the gate, and I drove in a big circle feeding my sheep. And when I was done, I whistled to load him up, and he's gone. And I'm like, man, he never goes anywhere. And whistle, he didn't come back. Eventually, I went back to where I sent him. And when I sent him over the hill, there was a pond in the back. And there was one sheep laying down in that pond in the mud that couldn't get out. And he went back to that sheep and lay down there. So I guess what happened, he came around there, the sheep was stuck, and he lay down. And then, you know, I got on him. He left that sheep, brought the rest. And the moment I took my eyes off him, he went back to lay down that sheep. Now, you know, that's the type of things that that I really enjoy about what we do. If you can get a dog to that level where it really starts to sort of make sense to you, you know, what he's doing.
It starts understanding the job that you guys are really after. It's you know, we have the dogs that can figure out pretty quick, like, okay, move the sheep from point A to point B. But the dogs that start piecing together why you're moving the sheep from point A to point B, that's when you start getting that level of cooperation that we want out of all of our dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to describe people, you know, to tell people how that communication works. That dog's mother was an incredible dog. I was driving sheep one day, long distance, and I was in my pickup about 150 yards behind the flock, and I had two dogs, and just casually drive down the road. It's just like a two-track road in rough country. And I watched her, and she came back in my direction and looked down on the ground and then went back to a flock, driving, and then came back a third time. Eventually, I caught up with her, and I stopped there. And then I guess people will know what an aardvark is or an ampere.
Mm-hmm.
They dig extremely deep holes. And he digged a hole right between the two tracks, and the sheep fell in it, and she was standing down there. Couldn't get out. And that dog picked it up that she was down there. Now, as the flock moved over this hole, I guess, one fell in. And, you know, I would have drove right over it, never even think about looking there. But she came back and showed me. So, you know, that's another example of dogs understanding what they do.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's invaluable as a farmer or anybody with a working dog. When they start, you get these dogs as a tool to help you save on effort and time, but then it ends up saving you money. I mean, you're a sheep farmer, right? So you got to have sheep to be successful and make your money and make your living. Well, that's two instances where your dog just helped directly with your bottom line, right? So, you know, you got the dog to herd sheep, but they're actually helping you keep your inventory, so to speak.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, that's there's a big difference between, you know, having dogs because of sheep and having sheep because of dogs.
Exactly. So this kind of popped a question in my head. You know, we're talking about a high level of cooperation here that really it probably was built over years of just work and teamwork. But when you talk about dogs and breeding the right dogs to do this, you know, in your opinion, in the sheepdog world, what's more important, drive or cooperation? And I know that you're going to say you need both, but, you know, which one are you going with if you had to pick one or the other?
Well, that's a hard question. It depends a lot for what, but I tell you what, I'll take a less talented dog that's willing to listen to me before I take a hard-headed one that doesn't want to, but just want to do his own. Because you do get dogs, you know, they're just not good listeners. They're very talented, but they do their own thing all the time. I, especially in the situation where I am now, which I actually don't have that time anymore to, and I don't get up to work my dogs as much, I'm definitely into the one that's, even if he's a little less talented, but he's really good listener, he really tries hard, I'll go for that one at this moment. And that might change. I might go back into work, you know, a big property again and a lot of sheep, and then I'll take that hard-headed dog and make him better. But you have to do what you can at the moment, I guess.
Yeah. So I want to know, you've talked a couple times about, say you're working out to 1,000 yards, that, you know, the dogs have to be able to hear you. But you've mentioned, you know, something like, you know, if the wind is wrong, the direction is wrong, or maybe there's an obstruction in the way that makes it hard to verbally communicate with the dogs, you know, maybe a whistle doesn't cut through it. You know, we can find ourselves in that situation all the time with these bird dogs while you're out hunting. So I'm interested, do you have some tricks or tips as far as being able to communicate with your dog at that far of a distance?
Yeah, hey, Mother Nature is hard to beat.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Nick, I don't know. I think, actually, I do know a little bit. I can give you an idea of what I think. It's about in the way you train your dog, too. It's not just a question that he should listen, right? Listening is just one part of it. Wanting to listen is another part of it. So if you can train the dog where he's actually sort of wanting to listen to you because he want to be right, you're going to find out. I ran two dogs the last 2 years. One is Jack and one is Sam. And Jack It's a less talented dog, but extremely good listener. And Sam is a hard-headed, talented dog. And the wind will blow. And we were in Missouri last year, and there's a big cross drive, like about 250 yards in front of us from left to right, and it was about 300 yards long. And the wind was just howling. And I got out there with Sam, and I could not make that dog. I could feel how it's like you lose your power steering. I go the same with Jack. I could whistle softer and he listened, but he wanted to listen. So you have to learn. So it's a type of dog. It's a type of training. Those things are extremely important. And then if you want to be really good, you better learn to whistle really good. There's no shortcut for that. I don't know. I'm not sure what you guys are using in our setup. A lot of people use different kind of whistles or fingers. But if you can, I've not seen anybody run a dog exceptionally well that's not a good whistler. So there's not many tricks. But I do know this, if your dog can come out there and just do his own thing because he's not well trained, you have a problem. He's going to take, we can say, advantage of a situation. That's not really it. He's just not going to listen because he doesn't want to.
Right. And so I'm curious. So, you know, you're talking about whistling, and obviously this whole thing is really about communicating with the dog at distances. Have you used, or do you have an opinion on e-collars? You know, I'm sure that you're not allowed to use those in competition, but as far as just training and working with your dog on your own farm, do e-collars come into play at all for you?
No, Nick, not at all. So with border collies, I think they're a little different, and we've bred them now. They've bred them for many years, and I think they sort of finally wired up in their minds, if I can put it that way, and you can screw them up extremely quickly. You know, there's a reason why border collies get fixated with everything. They chase flies, and they chase grasshoppers, motorbikes, lawnmowers, anything they can sometimes. So they can go mentally, they can go nuts real quick. If your dog, most people will put an e-collar on a dog because of a biting problem. And I've yet to see that work in the long term. Yes, you might avoid the bite, but you get serious other problems coming up from that. So, you know, there's only one way to do what we do and do it right, is you have to start at hand, close up, do the basics extremely well, and slowly extend that. There is no place for an e-collar in that.
Yep. So expand on that a little bit. You know, that's what we touched on a little bit earlier, you know, starting up close and then just building off of it. You know, obviously every dog's going to be a little different. There's missing context and in all of this, but just generalize a dog that you extend that distance out. Like, are you're doing one command at a time, teaching it right up front, and then you're going out. Like, I mean, when you talk about extending the distance, what are we talking about here? Like, are you jumping from right in front of you to 50 yards, then to 100 yards, or are we talking about a much smaller, gradual distance extension?
Okay, so let's go back to the training out of a small area where, you know, you might be start, you got the dog back off now, you stop on void command. Stop him in a neutral position, which will be where I know it's easy for the dog to stop. That means the sheep will not make him run away. So the next phase will be, okay, now I have to maybe let the sheep move a little bit and then try and stop him. So now there's movement involved. Because it's easy for the dog to stop when the sheep are standing still. When the sheep move, it gets harder and harder.
Yeah.
And then when I start putting this, dogs don't just go around the sheep on their own. Some do, but most probably don't. So we teach him to run out. You know, we cut him off, we block him off the sheep and push him off a little bit to the sides to open him up. So, and that's where the distancing come in. So you might start with 20 yards, 30 yards, 50 yards, and then you might stand, you know, maybe you stand halfway between the dog and the sheep in the beginning so you can push him off. Now, if you're happy with what he does, you don't extend that distance, you just make your distance to the dog shorter. So the dog is, but sound-wise, everything stays the same, so there's no way he can't hear commands. He's going to hear commands. Then once that is happening, the dog works from your feet at this small distance. Then you can start to think, okay, well, let's test him. I'm all for testing a dog. So I might give him a 150-yard outrun, let him come in behind and see if he'll stop for me. Now, if he blows me off completely and everything wins chaos, I'm like, okay, that was too quick. Now we go to 100 yards again. So it's a bit of a testing game. But there's something else I wanted just to touch on that, which I think most people, and I think this might cut through all kinds of sports and dog sports. Mm-hmm. When you train a dog, we all have an idea of what we want. So let's call that the calibration. So we all want to train a dog. It should work like that. You should maybe move from point A to point B, stop there, blah, blah, blah. There's a method. Everything should happen like that. And that's what we train for. So I know exactly what my outrun, we call it the way the dog goes around the sheep. I know what I want. So I train for that. But then if you just train that, you're making a problem for yourself because that's in a very controlled circumstances. You have to learn to put variation in there. So, and this is where I teach my dogs to listen to me. If my dogs really want to go to the left, I make them go right. If they really want to go, I make them stop. If they want to stop, I make them go. I call it a game of opposites. But you can also say, I train variation in my dogs, but not calibration. Calibration is important. That means the dog should know what he's doing when everything is right. But then can I change that? And that's where the dogs get really good, is when I can make them do the unnatural thing on command. And if I leave them, they should do the natural thing. So that's something to play with a little bit. I'm not sure if that's applicable with gun dogs.
No, it absolutely is. I mean, especially, you know, just putting in the form of what we already talked about, dog training is dog training, especially in terms of basic obedience. You know, something as simple as heel. You know, we do a lot of heel work with these dogs. And if you have a dog that's constantly pulling out in front of you, you know, a lot of people, they want to speed up. Well, that's just going to make the dog go quicker. And it's also rewarding what they want. So you need to do the game of opposite. You need to slow down. Same thing. If the dog's pulling off to the left, go right. And it's the same thing. And, you know, that's what we're all after when we're training these dogs. You know, if these dogs just came out of the box doing exactly what we wanted and we didn't have to train it or teach them, then there would be no dog training, right? They would just do what we want. But that's not what we're doing. Literally the entire thing that we're doing with dog training is getting them to do what we want them to do on command. And the level of distraction in the face of what's driving them, in our case, birds, your case, sheep, that's really the testament. Because in our world, we can get our dogs to do a lot in this backyard, you know, especially if you start doing with rewards or e-collar or pressure, whatever method people are using, you can get your dogs to do it if your dog has a lot of bird drive, there's no birds. But you put a dog in front of birds, their entire demeanor changes.
Everything changes now. Yeah. Now, I think that's if you can get your mind, you almost have to train for the wrong a little bit, if you can put it that way. Somebody one day watched me train, and I said, afterwards, she said, I know what my problem is. I train to get it right. You train for it to be wrong. Yep. And you fix it. So, you know, I'm pretty good at making a mess of something. I call it controlled chaos, and then try and teach the dog in that moment. And that comes from years and years working a lot of sheep and know what a mess looked like, you know.
Yeah.
I always think to make a good mess, you must know what it looked like. So.
Absolutely, yeah. I call it train hard, test easy. You know, in our tests, you can come across anything in a hunt test. You can deal with birds that don't fly. You can deal with gunner issues. You can deal with, you know, people getting the wrong way. You know, when you start dealing with wild animals, anything can happen. So, you know, if you test in a perfect – or if you train in a perfect scenario 100% of the time, you know, and your dog's not equipped to handle with something that doesn't go perfect, then you're in for a world of hurt during that test when you need it most.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. That's for sure. So
I'm curious, you know, you're talking a lot of verbal at this distance. Do you overlay any hand signals, or when you're talking at 1,000 yards, it's kind of pointless, you know, can hand signals work that well at that great of a distance?
So, you know, we try and stay away from that as because we want the dog's attention on the sheep all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want the dog. We always feel like it's a bit of a weakness if a dog keeps looking at the handler.
Yeah.
Because, you know, within a blink of an eye, a sheep make a bad move and get away or something like that. So there's people that I've seen, they use a little bit of hand signals, but no, we try and we use our body position a lot. So we move a lot in the beginning to teach with pressure. So you might have a rolled up plastic bag in my hand and bang it to my side. But eventually that's going to go away too. But as far as, you know, a specific hand signal for a specific side, I've seen that very rarely in my life. And I try to stay away from that because I want the attention on the sheep all the time.
Makes sense. Especially, I mean, yeah, when the whole goal is keeping sheep organized and moving in a certain direction, I'm sure one sheep getting out of formation can pretty much ruin the entire drive.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, they can get away from you sometimes. Huh?
Yeah, awesome. Well, I mean, what am I missing about this whole sheepdog world? You know, is there anything else that you can think of that would be beneficial for us as gun dog people or just dog enthusiasts in general that there's some overlap that we haven't touched on already?
You know, I've only hunted with dogs once or twice in my life, and they were really good ones, so I was a little spoiled. I don't know much about, about hunting dog training. So but I do think that, I think your game as well as our games is there's big differences between dogs. You know, we always say this in the sheep business, there's more differences in a breed than is between breeds.
Yep.
And I think, you know, if I can just generalize and say that in my world, most people do not acknowledge that different types of dogs can be handled a little different, and they're not all going to suit you. That's you know, that holds people back. I can't tell you how much, because once you give them to, like, you tell them that's like a challenge. Like, no, I'll get this. No, I don't think you're going to get it. But go ahead and try. And then when us 10 years you've been trying to do something with this dog, it's not possible.
Yeah,
I do think all dogs have limits. I think people need to learn to, you know, to think about what type of dog will suit, and I think it's the same in what you guys do.
Absolutely. It is. You get a lot of people, you know, especially first-time buyers, you know, they pick a breed because it's what their friends have or it's what they think looks the best. And there's certain traits and differences within different lines and breeders that would be a better fit for them. But, you know, they just kind of, I'm going to get a bird dog. And it's not until they're, you know, a few years down the road that finally it gets through their head to where it's like, oh, there might be an easier way for me on the next one, right?
Yeah, and I'm not saying give up on a dog. I'm one that I tell people, your first couple of dogs, you need to get them to the point where you can actually compete with them.
Right.
No, we don't have to be good at it. But, you know, competing in our world is all those things I just described when I said, you know, all the things I did with my dogs. That's a competition, just a refined form of it. So, you know, all dogs can go left, right, and stop and walk up. And you have to learn to take them there. And then if they're no good and you can't get on, then it's time to let go of them. But you know, as human nature, we can be a little quick to get to want to have results, I think. And
right.
So sometimes we're a little greedy in that department instead of just learn the trade right on the ground first. You know, get the basics really good and take it slow.
Yep. Makes sense. And I mean, that's a good tip for anybody in any world with dogs. And I'm just curious, you said that you've only hunted a couple times with some good dogs. You know, is that just from lack of opportunity or lack of time or lack of interest? You know, are you just busy with other stuff, or is that something that you would like to do if the opportunity presented itself?
Yeah, I think I quite enjoyed it. I would say all of those you mentioned was probably lack of opportunity, lack of time.
Yeah.
I'm just lucky that I can go to one place where the ladies is quite an interesting household. She runs sheepdogs and the guy's a hunter, and you got German Shorthairs. And so it was just an opportunity every time I come up there. And it's that time of year. He lives close to Denver. We'll go out and and hunt a little bit.
Gotcha.
And, you know, the best I've ever, and I have no idea, like I said, in South Africa, gun dogs is not a big thing. This specific day we were hunting and he had a young dog and the dog picked a bird up for me and he pointed another one while he had one in his mouth. And I thought that was one of the coolest things I've seen.
Yep. Yeah, there's some good ones out there. And you're down in Texas, right? What part of Texas are you in?
Yeah, we're just southwest of Dallas. We're in the Hyco, Stephenville area.
Okay.
Situated now.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll have to find you somebody down there in your neck of the woods if you wanted to give hunting with some dogs a few more opportunities. I guarantee you we can line that up, especially some guys down there with these field trial dogs that need some help communicating with their dog when they're 800 yards out, right?
Yeah. I'm not gonna get involved in that one before I know more.
It makes sense. Well, Fonzie, I appreciate it. Is there anywhere that you would like to direct people if they're interested in contacting you for training tips or questions or just to check out some cool sheepdogs?
Well, at the moment my website is a little bit at shangles. We stopped it because we're working on it, but they can get me on my Facebook page. I also got an Instagram. They can just Google my name.
Okay.
That's most probably the easiest. I do have an online training platform through LearnWorlds, but they're going to have to get to me to get that address. It's a little complicated address to get to them.
Gotcha. Well, I'll be sure to link your accounts on social media when we do the post for this episode. And Fonzie, I appreciate you taking the time and learning us up on some sheepdogs. You know, that's something that we don't get to experience. And I think especially here in America, most people don't understand just how big that world is when you start talking about international competition and contests, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the sheep business in America is a little down, so there's not a lot of dogs. But if you go down to Australia and where dogs are extremely important, New Zealand, the UK, they're still really, really work dogs. South Africa, there's a lot of work dogs. So there's a big world out there, and they still play a real big role in the farming and the everyday existence of farmers. Huh?
Yeah, awesome. Well, again, thanks for making time, and we'll have to check back soon with you.
Okay, thank you for having me, Nick.
Picture this. You just finished a long day's hunt, or a long day in the training field grooming your next champion. You've run through your entire string of dogs in anticipation for the next fall. You think the day's over. It's not, though. Your day's not over until you let that ugly dog hunt. No hunting or training session is complete without capping it off with one of the spirits from Ugly Dog Distillery. They're Michigan-raised and purebred handcrafted spirits. They have everything you need from vodka and gin to your more traditional after-hunt choice Kentucky bourbon. Head on over to uglydogdistillery.com to check availability within your state. And if you have an upcoming event that's alcohol-friendly, then be sure to reach out to us and see if we can add another Ugly Dog to the lineup. We'll tell you right now, we aren't much on flavored whiskeys, but you have to try their peanut butter whiskey. Unlike other peanut butter whiskeys out there, Ugly Dogs is made with real Kentucky bourbon and not just grain alcohol with syrup. So after your next hunt or a long day of testing and you're trying to decide what to drink, reach for the bottle with Ruger, the German wirehair pointer on it. It was handcrafted by people just like us, dog people. Every adventure starts somewhere. Make sure yours includes an ugly dog at your side. Explore responsibly.
All right, Harold, sheepdogs, what'd you think about it? Were you excited going into it, or were you like, really, sheepdogs? There's no gun involved in that.
I was actually really excited, mostly because I have a bit of a sheepdog, I guess, myself. Cue the meme.
He might have the breed, but it's never seen a sheep in its life, probably.
Yeah, it's seen some. It's seen livestock. It's seen some pheasant. It's seen squirrel, but it's not ever probably seen sheep, but... He's a beautiful Sheltie. He does have that natural herding thing. I guess like I can see the natural herding thing in him, like as you can see that in a bird dog. So it kind of just makes sense.
Well, I mean, did you know, like, obviously it doesn't translate into what we normally talk about on this episode, or it kind of loosely does, and that's why we had him on to talk about it, but like at first glance, you see sheepdog, you're like, how does that connect with the hunting dog or gun dog world. And so did you know anything about the sheepdog world or even the sheepdogs and just the type of training they do before listening to this?
I did not. Like I say, other than knowing that some of that herding was like instinctual, aside from that, I had no clue as far as how they go about doing anything or like running, directing that dog, especially trusting that dog far out and like recalling that dog and driving that dog.
Yeah. So you had never even seen it until I told you to watch some videos on YouTube. And so we just looked it up real quick. And like, it's one of those, like, if you listen to this episode and you didn't come away with a true understanding of what the sheepdog guys did, go check them out on YouTube. Right? Like, it's just, it's really impressive when you see a good quality sheepdog, whether it's in a competition or just some kind of demonstration and what they do. And then it's going to kind of click and make sense into you as why we had him on to talk about like just the obedience, starting close so that you can go far. And if you can get a dog to listen to you from just a whistle or your voice, you know, 500 to 1,000 yards out, that's impressive. And that's really, I think, where the overlap is, especially in the upland dogs.
I think, you know, I've never had a flushing dog or a lab, but kind of saw some overlap in that, even, I guess, with the signaling and with the tones and the whistles and like,
just not the range then.
Just not the range, yeah. But similarities in that. So it's kind of some overlap probably for flushing people or labs, even to some extent, just to kind of, you know, see how some of this relationship is built with the handler and that dog.
Yeah. And I think the most important thing to take away from this is the training starts up close and goes far out. So it starts in the short grass and goes to the tall grass. What we talk about all the time, if you can't get a dog to listen to you and obey you right next to you, how are you going to do it when they're 200-300 yards out and, you know, you need them to point that bird? Or, you know, not even 200-300 yards out, but just 50 yards out. You know, say you got a close working dog. You need that dog to mind you when it's that far out, especially, you know, in a safety situation. Maybe it's running towards a road or whatever you can imagine. I think there's a lot of overlap there. And just back to the foundations, which we preach all the time, and start in the short grass. Start in the backyard. Before you go out there, you can't go give a whoa when the dog is 80 yards out in the field if you haven't taught whoa up close in the backyard first.
Yes. Yeah, you can't teach it. Yeah, exactly.
Glad you agree with me. So, I mean, what was the other main thing that like you took away from it that stands out to you in your eyes?
Well, I guess to kind of segue from that, is kind of when you're saying, hey, how do I get this dog to listen to me up close and far away? Obviously, in our world, you know, there's a lot of check cording and then overlaying to e-collar. And then in that world, that's not really a thing.
Right.
So that I think that was interesting to see, especially, you know, like I said, like you suggested, watching some videos on YouTube of this, because it's really fun to watch. And it's kind of interesting to see that they kind of do that completely differently.
Just imagine all the stuff that they have to do out there in the fields. And we're a lot of times in the hunting dog community. So if people start using e-collars, how many of them do you think like really become overly dependent on the e-collar, right? It's very easy to do because it's a tool that you just charge up and you have control. Obviously, that's the whole point of it.
Control.
Yeah. But you know, you asked Fonzie in the episode, and he was, I mean, you could tell that, like, that would never even cross his mind to even needing an e-collar. And it just goes to show, if you go about this the right way and teach it and train it the right way, you don't need an e-collar. And, you know, we all come from the world, we've talked about it before, I think the e-collar makes our lives easier if used appropriately. But for those people that are saying, oh, well, it's sheepdogs, it's not bird dogs on birds, these dogs, again, go watch the videos because they are crouched. They are pointing these sheep like they are very intense. They have a drive, and you're still asking them to go against them wanting to attack the sheep to herd them. So it's like it's very similar in that regard. So it is really impressive to see them get this reaction out of the dogs without the need of an e-collar, which, again, We've talked about it on our end. We're not against them. We personally use them. Clearly, Fonzie doesn't, but that's okay. He doesn't need to, right? And he still has success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't need it, I think that's even – it's kind of more impressive in some ways.
Yeah.
So was there anything specific that you guys didn't dive into that you – like regret not going into?
Yeah, so I had it on my list and I just didn't get around to it. It just didn't really work into the flow of the conversation. Is one of the coolest things that these sheepdogs do is obviously they herd groups of sheep into specific locations and areas, but then they have to go in and by the direction of the shepherd pick out specific sheep from that group in a small pen and guide them out of there, or take two out of five over there, two out of five over there, and like specific sheep. So like, you know, these sheep have like blue or red collars, and the judge might tell you like, hey, pick blue or red collars, and you have to get that out of the entire group. Imagine doing that with your bird dog in a pen full of birds. No, I don't want that duck. Go get that duck.
Yeah, honestly, just watching
that duck has a band. Go get it.
Yeah, get the banded one.
Yeah,
and it's kind of watching the videos of them do that. It's kind of made me think about that parallel of, yeah, like we have a hard time finding birds, and these guys got to find a herd of sheep to work their dogs on.
Yeah, birds have definitely come by in the hard. There's been a real big shortage of birds all year, and imagine needing sheep to train. But these guys that are in it, man, like, again, we talked about it in the episode. And here in America, we may not understand or recognize how big this industry is, but you start looking on YouTube and online, like, it's huge when you go overseas. It's just huge. It would probably put like the amount of bird dog competitions we have here to shame as far as how many people show up to watch them. But it's just an interesting world, completely different than what we're used to normally. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, anything else that you thought was worthy of note? Or
I'm a little disappointed in the lack of Happy Day references.
Happy Day references?
Yeah.
Oh, Fonzie.
Yeah,
I got
joke
you.
Almost flew right over you.
It did. It almost missed me.
You know, last week we had Bruce on, and we could have had some ELO, Don't Let Me Down, Bruce. It's just like, these are teed up here, and they're going away.
Hey, man, you know, that's why we brought you on, man. We were missing too many opportunities. We needed a fresh change of pace and some horrible jokes that nobody gets, right?
Yeah.
No, Fonzie was great. And, you know, I heard him on another podcast a couple years ago, and then this actually came from a recommendation from Chris Elliott a couple months ago. And, you know, we've been playing phone tag and trying to get him on ever since. But Chris, appreciate the recommendation, and I always appreciate it when listeners come to me with topics but can also, like, connect me with a good quality guest, right? You know, getting a good quality guest is great. But without a topic, okay, we got to figure out the topic. You get a good topic, but no guests, it's like, okay, then I got to go digging and find that. So it's just like I take all the recommendations that people give me, and I have a running list, and I try and piece it together. But, you know, just wanted to throw that out there that we do appreciate listeners saying, hey, I'd like to hear from this guy on that topic. It's just boom, boom, makes it easier, mm-hmm. Right?
Totally. I think it, because there's, you know, We don't think of everything, obviously, and there's time like that. Something prime example of a lot of overlay, and it's just something interesting if you're into dogs in general and training. That I think that anybody would be fascinated, kind of diving into that at least mm-hmm. for an episode and a quick YouTube search.
Yeah, exactly. So, speaking of reaching out and helping us out, supporting the podcast, the survey went great. Appreciate everybody who took the time to fill it out. We're still going to leave it up for a little while. So if you have a moment and you want to do us a favor, fill it out. We'll still get, you know, shoot you a sticker if you want to. But we're going to go ahead and do the drawing for the Yukonuba giveaway for 3 months of food. So it's going to be that's obviously a pretty generous giveaway in my opinion. That gives you a chance to transition your dog to the new food and plenty of dog food to try out. And it's coming up right on hunting season, so it could be like a very noticeable change for you, right? So you know, unless you got something else to add, I'll go ahead and start off. I think I'm going to read the names, and the four names that I list off gets the 3 months free of Yukonuba. If they're listening to this podcast and they respond and hit me up by Friday, is that fair?
Sure.
By Friday, hit me up and you'll get it. If not, we're going to draw another name and go with them. That sound fair to you?
Yeah.
All right. So
it's exciting.
Wait, where's the drum roll, man? Yeah. Don't do it.
I won't do one here, but maybe I'll insert one. I don't know. We'll see how much time I have.
So you got Jeremy Lowry, Rose Danaher, Dustin Nichols, and Artin Marushin.
All right. Congrats, you guys. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, we definitely appreciate everybody who filled out the survey and entered in. You know, everybody that requested a sticker is going to get one. Obviously, these people get the dog food if they respond by Friday night. So,
lots of stickers going out in the old USPS. And this dog food situation is exciting. I'm excited for the winners here. And thank you guys for filling out the survey. We really helps us move things along here.
Mm-hmm. And speaking on helping us move things along, again, here in the next few weeks, I want to start transitioning over to more hunting concepts. And I got a few text messages and emails from some friends after last week's episode when I threw that out there, kind of giving us some good feedback and ideas on some topics. And then we got to go find some guests and everything, which is fine. But if you have specific topics or guests, you know, besides the how do I kill more birds, right? You know, that's very vague. Like we want just like the training topics we do. We want it, you know, how does this particular skill set translate over into the grouse woods or the chukar mountains, you know, stuff, you know, if it's something that I'm not familiar with, it's going to take a second to find a guest. So the sooner you get your recommendation into us, I can start reaching out, Harold can start reaching out, and we can start trying to do some good guests. But I don't know about you, I'm in hunting frame of mind. You know, it's still training season, but it's 1,000 degrees outside. I'm ready for fall, I'm ready for winter, I'm ready to hit the woods, hit the prairies with my dogs and go shoot some birds. Why we got into it. And so my mind is on hunting. You know, training season is wrapping up, so we'll come back to it and still talk about the training as we go through these episodes. But I don't know about you, like I'm ready to really jump in with 2 feet into hunting topics.
Yeah, my mind's always on hunting, really. I train and I fish to pass time.
Yeah I can see that.
I'm excited. And this year it's funny because normally I'm out in the yard shooting my bow and getting that dialed in to go get some early whitetail. And I'm really haven't done that much. And I'm kind of just thinking about early honkers and early teal right now.
So you don't have any desire to go deer hunting this year? This is your first full season, full hunting season with your dog though.
Mm-hmm.
So like you got her last December. Yeah, so like you got her late season. So yeah, I've been there to where it's just like, I don't even want to go deer hunting. But you're going to want to go deer hunting because at the end of the season, if you don't go, then that freezer looks pretty empty.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's hard to fill a freezer up with some upland birds, at least especially where we're from down here in Tennessee.
Yeah, I will. I certainly will go deer hunting. It's just I'm usually a little bit more hype about it than I am. I'm looking at it as a freezer filler situation. Like, and that's kind of what's caveated me into the dog anyways, just because I just go out and shoot a few deer and get them in the freezer to eat off of, and I'm happy to go get a variety of other things such as ducks and birds and, you know, whatever.
Maybe some
else,
squirrels or rabbits.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, we just had rabbit a couple nights ago, actually.
Yeah,
pan fried.
We're gonna have to have you do some like little cooking videos at some point or something.
Me cooking Hank Shaw's recipes.
Pretty much. But yeah, no, that's what I'm looking forward to is really getting back into the hunting swing of things. And then, of course, you know, by the end of hunting season, I'll be ready to, all right, let's get into training season again. But anything you can think of, you know, just shoot them to us. And we'll be happy to take a look at it and discuss. And again, if you have some specific people in mind for those topics, even better. But if you don't have anything else, you better have one thing ready right now, and that's a review of the week.
I do have a review of the week here.
You better, or else you're going to be fired real quick.
It's from Landon. I guess we say their names. Did we say their names?
If you put it in the...
He did put it in here. He put Landon Lippinen. That's what I'm going with.
What's his username? Busy guy from Minnesota.
Yeah, and that's what I was about to say. He's from Minnesota. It's pretty cool. I got married in Minnesota. So his review says, I had just picked up my versatile breed puppy, DD, a little over a year ago. Once I found this podcast, I listened to it nonstop till I knocked them all out. Wow. The knowledge shared between the host and guest has been the biggest help I've ever received with training a dog of any breed. From a brand new puppy to training to testing, there's no way I could have done it as smoothly as I did. Keep up the great work, and thank you very much. Signed, Landon.
Now, that's a bit. That's a big review.
That's a big review. Appreciate it, Landon.
Coming from a DD guy, a Drott guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. I'm glad that we could help anybody in any way. But, you know, for him to say that we pretty much helped him on everything from, you know, just basic obedience to testing and everything, that means a lot. And that's ultimately why we did this. Again, we really appreciate it.
It also drives home the fact that those old episodes still hold water and
they're
worth listening to if you're a new listener.
We do need to touch on that real quick. So we've been getting a lot of people asking for specific topics that we've already covered in the past, and we still plan on coming back around and covering some more again. But we have a huge library. I mean, we've been doing this, you know, there's 100 other episodes out there that we've touched on a lot of the stuff that you might be interested. So on our website, gundogityourself.com, we are in the process of setting up different playlists for you. So say that you're in the middle of puppy training, like Landon was at one point, and listening to it. You want to see all the behavioral theory or basic obedience theory or just foundational episodes, you know, you'll have, boom, all right there. And then force fetch retrieving episodes, boom, right there. You're a hound guy, you like the hog episodes, you like the coon hunting episodes, boom, right there. We're just trying to make it easier for people to search by topic and subject as you go through some of them. Because, I mean, you know, forgive me, some of the early ones, they're pretty rough on the audio content while we were figuring it out. I go back and cringe listening to me on the first few episodes. I mean, there's some current episodes that I cringe on my how I speak or how I come across. I bet. But yeah, it's one of those, like, there are some really good information back there. And it's funny, like, when I get on the phone with some of the guests that call and ask questions, I'm referencing a lot of episodes that we've already covered, and yes, I'm having to go back and I'm like, what number was that? Okay, so that's what we're going to try and do. If it's not up today, it will be up soon, sometime this week. But yeah, we just wanted to make it easier for the people that are, you know, have specific things that they want to hit. I think last week I got hit up about force fetch. I got hit up about how do you plan a hunt. I got hit up about basic obedience. The key things that we always get hit up on is just like, hey, just go to the website. Boom, right there. Listen to it.
Yep. You go there and it'll be like it'll look like a Spotify player, and it is, it's an embedded Spotify player. So, and don't, yeah, I guess that's also to let you know our stuff is on Spotify too, if you happen to use that as well. So
it's on all platforms.
It's on all of those.
Well, if there's anything else,
I think that's it. So,
all right, well, we'll wrap it up and we'll be back next week with a return guest.
That's right.
She's been on a number of times. I'm sure you all can guess it and look forward to that. So appreciate everybody listening. We'll talk next week.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to GDIY. If you enjoy this podcast, please remember to take a moment to rate, review, and share with a friend. Also, be sure to follow us and our partners on Facebook and Instagram under Gundog It Yourself. If you really enjoy the podcast and would like to contribute even more to the future content, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/Gundog It Yourself. Thanks again, and happy hunting. Everyone seems to have the same questions or concerns when they start trying to decide which kennel to purchase for their vehicle. Perhaps it's time to stop asking all the questions and just design the perfect setup that meets your exact needs. B-Pro Kennel specializes in designing and fabricating custom premier dog boxes handcrafted right here in the USA from high-grade, lightweight aluminum. They'll get you set up with the size dimensions, lighting, storage, battery boxes with solar charging, and anything else you can dream of. Stop stressing over buying the wrong setup just after replace it again in a year. Go ahead and check out bprokennels.com and get exactly what you want.
If you're considering changing your dog's food soon, then be sure to check out Eukanuba Pro Performance. Their science-backed formulas are designed to take your dog to the next level of performance. They also now have the new puppy formula to help your pup start strong and live active. When looking at all the different food options, remember Eukanuba to help power their ultimate performance.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Bob from Lone Ducks Gun Dog Chronicles podcast. I hope you just enjoyed the episode you just listened to. And if you did, I think you'll enjoy hopping on ours. We've got professional retriever trainers and upland bird dog trainers from across the country and world sharing their tips and tricks and great stories to help you and your dog get ready for the season. We'll see you there.